Okie dokie, greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 4th, 2008. I'm coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this lovely early summer, late spring, or mid-spring day. Today we have as our guest one of our favorite periodic guests here at Media Matters, Janine Jackson, Program Director for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, will be joining us with her critique of news media, what's going on today, her assessment. Should be a wonderful hour. Please join us today. But first, before we go to Janine Jackson and Fair, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Kevin Martin has announced that the agency will craft a new plan for the creation of a national public safety communications network. The FCC attempted to build a network by creating a public-private partnership that would combine spectrum controlled by a public safety trust and spectrum won by a commercial bidder in the recent auction of the 700 megahertz band. But the auction failed to meet the minimum bid for the public safety airwaves known as the D block. At a House hearing on the auction, several members of the Commerce Committee voiced their concern about the failed effort to produce a public safety network. Representative John Shimkus of Illinois spoke of the urgent need for an emergency network for first responders.
September 11th, Katrina, this is something public policy always, we have to get right. We're going to be held accountable, and we should be if we don't get this right.
Chairman Martin placed a lion's share of the blame on Congress for not legislating a federally funded public safety system.
The simple reality is that public safety does not have the funds to build a network. It would have been better to take the auction proceeds and provide the public safety community with the resources needed to build their own interoperable network. But we do not have the authority to directly fund such a network. As a result, the public-private partnership was the only means available to us to address this crucial issue.
FCC Commissioner Michael Kopp said that a public safety network was his first priority, but a public-private partnership was not ideal. He has long favored a federally funded network that would allow for emergency workers to communicate all across the country.
If the previous commission in those anxious days following 9/11 had dedicated itself to working with the Congress towards this end, we might actually have made it happen. But that was then, this is now, and different realities prevail.
Absent a congressional bill to fund an emergency network, the FCC will try again to auction off the spectrum for the D block. Representative Anna Eshoo of California cautioned the commissioners to take their time in analyzing what went wrong and restructuring the rules for another auction.
I think that the commission has to undertake a more thoughtful process that produces a licensee that has the resources to quickly build out a public safety network. It's a high obligation that the Congress has and the FCC has.
When the Federal Communications Commission decided last December to permit media companies to own a broadcast station and a daily newspaper in the same market, both the Senate and the House introduced bills to throw out the new rules. Last week, the so-called resolution of disapproval, a rarely used type of bill that essentially acts as a legislative veto, passed out of the Senate Commerce Committee by a unanimous vote. Andrew J. Schwartzman, director of the public interest law firm Media Access Project, says the resolution seems primed for passage in the Senate, and he's optimistic that it will pass in the House. But will it actually be put into effect?
The touchier question and the much more interesting question is what happens if it passes, as is likely, both the House and the Senate. The president has said that he would veto legislation, and then there would have to be a veto override. And that, it will be a very close vote in both the House and the Senate.
The resolution's quick passage out of committee might have been hastened by news reports that broke just 2 days before the vote. Media mogul Rupert Murdoch wants to buy Newsday, which would give him 3 daily newspapers in the New York market. He already owns the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, and 2 TV stations. Not to mention the Fox Network, Fox News Channel, movie studios, and the rest of his media empire.
The fact that Murdoch may be acquiring Newsday added fuel to the fire in the Senate and undoubtedly helps raise the visibility of the media concentration issue in the Congress generally.
Schwartzman says there's nothing to stop Murdoch from purchasing Newsday. The FCC has no jurisdiction over newspaper ownership. But Murdoch's two television licenses are under challenge, and the Newsday sale could complicate matters.
The only area of FCC interest and jurisdiction is when Murdoch would be owning and operating television stations and three newspapers in the New York City market, and that's what the FCC would focus on. In order to keep the three newspapers, it may well be necessary for him to have to sell off one or both of his television stations.
But Schwartzman says Murdoch's television stations are very profitable. In fact, Channel 5 might be the most profitable TV station in the country, and Murdoch, ever the shrewd businessman, won't want to give them up.
His television licenses are jeopardized. He may have to rethink his newspaper practices.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. The media, as always, are in the news themselves for their influence on how they cover politics and our lives and the importance they play. One of the central groups that has done tremendous work over the past now two decades, publicizing criticism of the media, raising the critique of media, has been Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And today joining us as our guest is their longtime program director and the host and producer of their radio show, Counterspin, which can be heard here at WILL on Thursday nights at 10:30 p.m. or on our local sister community station, WEFT, Mondays at 5:30, is Janine Jackson. Janine, thank you for joining us.
It's always a pleasure, Bob.
It's funny, Janine, you've been in this racket a long time, as have I. It doesn't seem like there's any lack of need for media criticism today. It's not going away, is it?
It certainly isn't. There's always more work for us to do. It seems like we, despite the economy's ups and downs, media critics are always in work. I guess the good thing is there are more of us now.
That's true. It's almost a banner market right now for media criticism. I mean, you go down the issues, and let's just dive right into some of the issues that FAIR's been working on and that everyone's talking about, too. And that you've been covering on Counterspin. And I think the one is on most people's minds right now is the coverage of the presidential race.
Absolutely.
Especially on the Democratic side, but I do want to talk about the coverage of the Republican side and prospective, presumptive nominee John McCain. But what is your take on the Clinton-Obama race so far? How's FAIR been assessing the news coverage of the Democratic side?
Well, I've just been watching CNN this morning, in which a great volume of coverage was dedicated once again to Reverend Wright, to Barack Obama's former pastor, and it was amazing how much conversation there could be, in which the topic seemed to be, should we really be talking about this? And so unenlightening. And I mean, I guess that's just one example that's on the forefront right now of the way that the issues, what have become the media's issues in this presidential election, are so far away from what people, when you talk to them, say they care about and say they want to talk about. You know, the focus on comments, the focus on connections with folks, and here there's also, of course, a double standard to be talked about in terms of the treatment of Reverend Wright, but even in the bigger picture, just the level of substance of conversation that the media are having in this election, while it's not surprising, it still is, once again, as it is each time around, very, very depressing and very, very far away from what poll after poll tell us people actually want to talk about.
And what was striking in the last presidential debate in Pennsylvania, just prior to the Pennsylvania primary, ABC News hosted it, as I recall, and they spent the first hour basically discussing the sort of quote-unquote character issues, which is sort of like calling them like reality TV shows, I guess.
It really was such a misery, wasn't it, with Charlie Gibson and George Stephanopoulos? And it was interesting, their reaction to that debate, because a lot of folks really thought, oh, is this not just the quintessential example of the problems that we're talking about, where oh, Obama's comments about people being bitter, which had already been hashed and rehashed, and if you cared about it, you'd read 27 stories on it already. But in this opportunity, this prime opportunity of a live debate, this is what these ABC anchors choose to just go through again and again. And what some folks said was it seemed like they were just trying to manufacture a moment, you know, trying to generate some heat, maybe get Obama and Clinton to say something mean to one another on live TV. And again, the question is, as a voter, what does that do for you? And what does that say about the way journalists are using this incredible responsibility that they have all the time, of course, but it's so clear at an election time, the role that we need journalists to play in informing people about candidates' policies, about their public records, about what they say they might do should they become president. And they're just running 180 degrees in the opposite direction, as that debate, I think, made clear.
One thing that also was interesting about that debate, Jeanine, was that ABC News, just a week, I think, before the debate, had broken a story about how in the White House itself, members of the cabinet and top members of the administration, including Vice President Cheney, had actually participated and choreographed in meetings to discuss how to interrogate prisoners at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And in fact, from what we can see, torture them.
Exactly.
ABC News broke the story, yet when they hosted the debate, that subject didn't come up.
Well, and you know, it seems like there's a real disconnect. And you know, you and I obviously talk about this all the time, but we also know that journalists also complain about this. And you can imagine, you know, media outlets are not monoliths. You can imagine ABC journalists, you know, who were themselves furious with the silliness of that debate, because clearly there are real journalists working there who are capable of breaking serious stories and of doing the kind of public interest journalism that we really need from them. And I think those, although they often suffer in silence because they're on the inside, those journalists are some of the biggest media critics that there are. And I would note about that debate, though, that while we say, oh, wasn't it embarrassing and wasn't it trivial, I remember David Brooks, the columnist at the New York Times, said that, you know, he gave ABC an A for that debate. He thought the questions were excellent. You know, we are not necessarily, not everyone shares our view that that was a real letdown of journalistic responsibility.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jeanine Jackson, the Program Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You can learn about FAIR at fair.org on the Internet. She's also the producer and co-host of Counterspin, their radio show, which can be heard right here on WILL every Thursday night at 10:30 or on our sister station, WEFT, Mondays at 5:30. She often writes for Extra, the publication of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, someone I think many of our listeners are familiar with. It's an honor to have her with us on the air today. Our phone number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Jeanine Jackson, I'm often asked my assessment of the coverage of the two Democrats because there's so much interest in this race because it's almost we have to go back literally generations to a presidential race that's dragged out this long where you've had two finalists.
Right.
And the media has played such a large role in sort of setting discussion on certain issues like Reverend Wright and others. As you look at the coverage and as the people at FAIR research this and write about it, do you think that their media has one candidate's gotten a better deal than the other in the press over the past, say, 3 months?
Well, what's been interesting about if we just look at Democrats for a minute, what's been interesting has been the kind of shifting of media affections. Thomas Edsel had a piece in the Washington Post last week talking about how Obama seemed to be a media favorite for some time for all kinds of reasons, some of them creepy, you know, that we can talk about. But then Hillary Clinton was coming from behind, and, you know, that was an interesting storyline to people. And so then the press seemed to be favoring Clinton. What struck me about it was not so much who were the media for or against, but really the way the story has become who do media like, which again is completely divorced from what a democracy is meant to be talking about. It's been kind of what storylines do journalists favor? Do they think Obama is saying the right kinds of things to appease them, you know, to appeal to them? Mm-hmm. I have the feeling it's only cable hosts who care about Barack Obama's bowling, for example, you know, but it's become such a kind of insular conversation where it's really about who do media like best, and it's sort of whether that's Clinton today and Obama tomorrow is almost less interesting to me than the fact that they really think it's about them. You know, they really think it's about pleasing them. And then if you look at the bigger picture, who is getting the easiest? I think you have to say John McCain. I think you have to pull a little bit back and talk about, and there'll be a big piece in the next issue of Extra by my colleague Peter Hart about the myth of the maverick, the inescapable set of myths that seem to surround Senator John McCain, many of which have just no bearing. His public record does not bear them out, but they have become the preferred storyline. And of course, I'm talking about the fact that he is known for bucking the party line. He's been called a maverick by virtually everyone in the media, you know, although I think Time magazine did it best by calling him a free-ranging, fence-jumping, kick-the-corral maverick. but the idea is that he frequently votes against the Republican Party. And when you look at his record, that's just not the case. In fact, his history, his voting history, has shifted somewhat. But for much of his career, he's been a pretty reliably conservative candidate and not actually a fence-jumper or a coalition builder. But media acknowledge that this is the storyline, this is the picture of John McCain that they're going to put forward, and it almost becomes facts be damned. I think that's really favoring McCain at the moment, and what we've seen in just the last week has been a real strange kind of comment from some journalists, including Gwen Ifill at PBS and a couple of others, in which they say, we're going to start scrutinizing John McCain any minute now, you know, watch for it. He should not be getting too comfortable because we're going to be scrutinizing him. You know, that's a very weird admission for journalists to make, I think, that they are not, in fact, actually engaged in the job of scrutinizing the candidates right now, but that it's on their to-do list.
We're going to have Paul Waldman on the air in an upcoming show to talk about the press coverage of McCain. He just wrote a book with David Brock on that subject. And one of the things I'm interested in is, you know, by all accounts, McCain gets great press. I mean, I think his Republican competitors were always aware of this, and it frustrated them in the race for the nomination. And he, I think by all accounts, gets wonderful press now. He sort of is truly Teflon with the media, if not the public. Why do you think that is? What is it about John McCain that sort of gets a press that is, you know, full of adulation?
Well, I think one of the things to remember about much of our elite press corps, I choose that word carefully, they really do see themselves as gatekeepers. You know, they're going to, they understand better than us, the hoi polloi, you know, the real machinations of politics and what actually needs to go on and what kind of person you really need to be to succeed. And they take that information and then they decide which of it, you know, the public should be let in on, essentially. We frequently talk about the way journalists winnow the field. They essentially tell us which presidential candidates are worth our time and which they have decided on our behalf, thank you very much, don't merit any attention whatsoever. John McCain, I think, does well with journalists by going directly to that kind of gatekeeper sensibility they have. When you ask journalists about his Teflon coverage, what they talk about is he gives us access. You know, he lets us sit and talk with him for hours at a time. He lets us hang out and eat with him, you know, and ride the bus, you know, with him. And I think that being on the bus really encourages journalists to be on the bus. They feel like they are getting something special by being able to simply sit in the company and kick back with this powerful official, and that kind of makes them feel like, you know, they're on the team too, and they don't want to hurt this guy. They know this guy. He's John McCain, you know. He's the guy from the bus. And they kind of step away from what ought to be their independent observer critical role and become insiders, you know, which is exactly what we don't need. And I think McCain has really played that very well with his kind of hail fellow well-met behavior with journalists. And I think journalists have returned the favor by not asking the kind of hard-hitting and critical questions that they ought to.
Yeah, I'm reminded, you know, Frank Rich had a piece, I believe, in the Times this morning, New York Times this morning, about Reverend Hagee, And, you know, we've heard so much about Reverend Wright. And then Reverend Hagee has gotten almost no coverage, I think, by comparison.
Exactly. And this is a guy who has not just endorsed John McCain, but as it later came out, he declares that McCain sought his endorsement, you know, that this was not, as Bill Kristol had it, he said, it doesn't really matter. There's no comparison between Reverend Wright, who was Obama's pastor, and this guy, Reverend Hagee, because Hagee's just a random individual who happens to like John McCain. Well, no, he's not that. He actually is a powerful figure that whose endorsement McCain sought and who McCain has appeared with and so forth and so on. So I think there is clear evidence of a double standard.
Yeah, what if Reverend Wright had said some of the comments about Roman Catholics, for
exactly,
example, that Reverend Hagee has said?
It's called the Catholic whore church, you know, and all manner of alarming and frightful things that we could spend. You know, that could be the tape loop that we are seeing again and again and again instead of Reverend Wright. I think we need to remember that every time you see yet another clip of Jeremiah Wright, that's an outlet making a choice not to bring you another story, but to instead, again, bring you a clip that they've shown you 15 times. And whatever the commentary is that follows it, the big message is, this is important, this is valid, this is a legitimate concern in this presidential race. That's a choice being made. And so you do have to take it seriously when there is a quite analogous or comparable or potentially comparable situation that doesn't get the same play.
Janine Jackson, we have a few callers waiting patiently, but I do want to follow up on this Reverend Wright issue because I just wonder how much of this is not just about Obama, just about Democrats or anything, but how much of this has race in it? I mean, in your view, how much of this is, you know, this is basically, you know, trying to basically freak white Americans out about a black guy?
It seems quite clear to me, actually, and one of the that is a strong and central element of it, and one of the things that it has been striking has been journalists spent a week or more talking about Reverend Wright, but then when Reverend Wright gave a speech, the conversation from the Howard Kurtzes at the Washington Post and others was, oh, well, this guy sure grabbing his 15 seconds of fame. He really loves the sound of his own voice. It was fascinating because apparently what you're supposed to do is be talked about. And I think that goes especially for black people. You know, black people for the mainstream media are meant to be discussed and not actually to speak in their own voice. And when they do, suddenly they've talked too much and too loudly. And I think that is definitely an element here, and it's been an element in coverage of Obama, which I think ties to this. The media love story with Obama had to do with him being post-racial or transcending race, and Chris Matthews came out and said it a little more directly. He said, you know, there's no anger with this guy. There's no history of slavery with him. You know, so Obama was somebody who a lot of elite pundits and journalists were very comfortable with because essentially he was a black man who didn't talk a lot about the suffering and the injustice and the racism that black people face in this country, and that made him more palatable. When you can connect him to Reverend Wright, who talks precisely about those things, who is not happy about the state of racial affairs in this country, then you bring up all of that whole ball of unexplored, unexamined issues that are racism in this country that media like to talk about but not really fully engage, and that's what's happening here. Lots of heat, but not very much light.
And for the life of me, I'm still trying to figure out, and I'm not asking this facetiously, it's a serious question. I mean, what exactly is the significance of Reverend Wright to Obama's campaign for presidency? I'm absolutely lost. I mean, they say, well, it's how he chose his preacher as a sign of his judgment. How he picked his launderer is? I mean, where do you draw the line in this?
Well, and I think many of the, many Americans are churchgoers, and I think if they ask themselves honestly, do you agree with everything your pastor says or your former pastor? I just think it's a crazy sort of situation. But again, if we tie it back into race, what I see as racist trends in media, this is a one of long standing in which black political figures are repeatedly called upon to distance themselves from, to reject other black figures, and it really doesn't even matter how, if you have any connection at all. You know, I mean, before this, Obama was having to say that he didn't like Farrakhan.
I know.
You know, and so, you know, I'm surprised he hasn't been asked to weigh in on Wesley Snipes, as someone was saying. You know, I mean,
how about OJ?
How do you feel about the new Will Smith movie? I mean, it becomes absurd at a certain point the way media see every black leader as accountable for everything that every other black person has done. And again, the point is the double standard that, you know, Hillary Clinton is not being called to account for everything said by a woman, you know, or certainly any number of things that she might be. So the question is, why does that standard get applied to one candidate and not another? And I think it's hard to get away from race as an explanation there.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Janine Jackson, who you've just been listening to. Janine Jackson is the Program Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. You can learn all about FAIR on the web at fair.org. She's also the producer and host of Counterspin, which can be heard right here in WILL every Thursday night at 10:30 p.m. Also can be heard on WEFT at 5:30 on Mondays. We have three people very patiently waiting to speak with Janine Jackson. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just heard a figure. I don't know if FAIR did the study, but it's something like 14 times as much reporting on Wright as Hagee. But I wanted to leave the horse race a little bit and ask you about what I've been tracking, which is this differential reporting of the good Kurds and the bad Kurds, if you will. I brought this up with Narman Solomon. And I have been a broken record on it, but it just bothers me so much. And now Iran and Turkey are getting together and attacking apparently both PKK and PJAK. The reason I bring it up for the media show is that October 23rd, there was an article that featured this and the allegation by Iran that the U.S. is arming this group to, you know, a proxy war, the other proxy war. Maureen Dowd referred to it the following week. There has been very little comment on this, CIA project or whoever's doing it, of actually arming about five or six different groups, and no one seems to be tracking it. Now, there are some things breaking the story, it seems to me. Los Angeles Times had a feature on it, but it still doesn't get commented on, and I just would beseech FAIR to track this story because it's very threatening in the context of Andrew Coburn's Counterpunch article, which was just splashed yesterday, that there 6 weeks ago there was a secret finding that apparently the Democrats signed on to allow for more covert operations to go again and continue this proxy war against Iran. We hear, you know, mild exhortations about how from the Democrats that they would or pledges that they would negotiate in good faith, but they seem to be signing on to this proxy war, and it really needs to be discussed, it seems to me. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Janine?
Well, I certainly take his point that, and I think there are the role that the Kurds have played and play, continue to play in the Iraq War, it's been interesting because they don't fit into, I think, a lot of Americans who read the paper couldn't even tell you that Kurds were part of Iraq. It's not part of the story that we generally hear. It generally gets a sort of different sort of coverage. I'm by no means an expert on it, and so I can't speak to the details. But what I would say is I do have an inkling of why we would not be hearing from the mainstream media in the main about, you know, behind-the-scenes things that the CIA are doing. And I think, you know, we can tie that directly to what was the big blockbuster story and sort of continues to be the blockbuster story of last week, which is David Barstow's piece at the New York Times on the Pentagon pundit campaign, you know, in which we have government officials actively using sources, retired generals, sending them out to the media. They called them message amplifiers, you know, essentially paid to be mouthpieces for the Pentagon, and these people showing up overwhelmingly informing and shaping television debate in particular is what this investigation is about, but we see them throughout the media. You know, these people are not independent analysts, the people who are telling us what to think and when to think it about what's going on in Iraq. It turns out a lot of them are mouthpieces for the Pentagon. So why do we not hear about covert operations that seem to go against what has we've been told is the mission, that seem like things that might potentially be disastrous? Well, we don't hear about them in good part because of who the media choose to listen to, who they choose to bring on as their sources, who they choose to allow to shape the story. I think the caller also, even in the context of his totally understandable frustration about the difficulty of getting information, he also points to, you know, he says, well, he saw Andrew Coburn at Counterpunch. He saw, you know, he did see one piece in the LA Times. It suggests that even on stories like this, there's information out there if one makes a very proactive, very aggressive effort to seek it out, and if one carries constantly the inclination to question the view that they're getting from, say, the New York Times.
Janine Jackson, what's a bigger story? The New York Times report last week of how the Pentagon basically has created this propaganda arsenal to shape the news to be pro-war. That's gone on for years very successfully, or the fact that there was hardly any follow-up of that story whatsoever in the news media?
I'm going to obviously go with the latter because we have no right to be surprised about this Pentagon program, for heaven's sake. You know, last week I've really been reminded of a quote that Howard Kurtz, the Washington Post media critic, had just a few days really after September 11th, very early on in the war on terror, as we now know it, in which he had a military official say, this is the most information-intensive war you can imagine. And he was talking about not Afghanistan, not Iraq, but the war on terror. We're going to lie about things. This military official told Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post, we're going to lie about things. You know, there's not any question that the government was going to dissemble, that they were going to outright lie, that they were going to cover up information, and that they were going to do everything they could to strategically get their point of view out. That should have been a given. So for me, it's a much, much bigger story that media outlets took the bait. In other words, someone can always pitch, but somebody's got to catch. And what this story at the New York Times shows is that There are a lot of people catching out there. There are a lot of people whose reliance on their belief in these military officials is such, their reliance on them as sources is such that, you know, they're not going to stop using them even now that they've been told that these people are paid to do PR for the Pentagon. We know we're going to still see these same retired generals again. They're not going to go away. They're going to continue shaping the story. So the fault here, obviously, I wish the government weren't doing what it's doing, but journalists are meant to, that's why we've got the First Amendment, is so they can put that in check. And the fact that everyone just kind of took that New York Times story and said, well, huh, okay, now back to business as usual, that's the real indictment.
And in fact, Janine Jackson, one of the really interesting pieces that FAIRD has done recently is up on the website, and it was in one of the e-blasts that FAIR sends out to people who sign up for it, and I urge listeners to do so if they want. It's free, and you get updates on what's going on once or twice a week, all the time. But one of them was sort of, you did, at the fifth-year anniversary of Mission Accomplished, you issued a report of all the current pundits and great thinkers of our news media with their assessments at the time of Mission Accomplished on the state of the Iraq War. And even for someone like me, who is expected to see utter silliness, I was still astounded at just how full of baloney and bombast and arrogance it seemed like almost uniformly our punditocracy was 5 years ago.
It's wonder. I would encourage folks to look at that. I'm not going to say it gives you a laugh, but I will say that it gives you a shudder that can be useful. You've got folks like Charles Krauthammer, who said in April of 2003, the only people who think this wasn't a victory are Upper West Side liberals and a few people here in Washington. Newsweek's Howard Fineman, we had controversial wars that divided the country. This war united the country and brought the military back. You know, what I think is interesting is, you know, when you do math in school, you're always asked to show your work. In other words, you're not allowed to just say, here's my conclusion. You have to say, here's my thought process. Here's my criteria. Here's how I came to this conclusion. You have these pundits offering what seem to be, you know, very edumacated opinions. You know, they have details to their explanation of why the Iraq War was going to be so easy, why it was going to be such a cakewalk. They didn't just say it. They offered explanations. They made fun of people who disagreed. Now, they don't have to apologize. And more importantly, they don't have to say, here's how my thinking has changed. You know, here's how I came from believing that this was going to be very easy and over in a week to, you know, here's how I still have the pride to stand before you today and continue offering my opinion. They don't have to show how they evolved, how their opinions changed, how they incorporated new events and information. They just get to show up the next day and say something entirely different and be completely unaccountable for it. It's really, really remarkable to me.
Well, the same people who were saying this are now talking in the same terms about Iran or Venezuela or some other country with no more evidence than they had then.
Exactly, and you can just kind of substitute Venezuela or Iran into some of those old pieces, and I'm really dismayed to see the extent to which people kind of fall for it. You know, I mean, you at least think, oh, well, maybe there's a grain of truth to what they're saying. Why does there need to be a grain of truth to what they are saying when you read some of the things that they've said before, and when you know that Chris Matthews, for example, couldn't find a particular country on the map a few weeks ago until they sort of get the feeling from the White House or from whomever that, oh, Venezuela, that's going to be what we're going to talk about now. North Korea, Syria. And suddenly you have these guys acting as though, oh yes, North Korea's been on my mind a great deal recently, and I'm glad you brought it up, Mr. President, because I've been dying to talk about it. No, they're just following along on the White House's lead, and it wouldn't matter so much except that they don't bring on other folks who know better. You know, they don't allow in the voices of truly independent folks who could provide some kind of counter-argument to the uninformed ones that they're putting out.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Coming to you live May 4th, 2008. Our guest is Janine Jackson, Program Director for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and the host and producer of Counterspin, which can be heard here on WILL every Thursday night at 10:30. Let's go back to the phone line. We have some very patient callers who have been waiting. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, this is wonderful. I wish both of you all could get on the mainstream media, either MSNBC, CNN, or any of the, and Fox News. If you all could clean that up, it would be wonderful. I'm African-American, grew up in the South, transposed to the Midwest, but I grew up doing Jim Crow, and there's no way in heck I would have ever thought that Barack Obama would be, or any African-American would be, a legitimate candidate for president in my lifetime. And therefore, I take it personal. When I do look at MSNBC, Fox News, when I'm having an hallucination, CNN, and even Stephanopoulos and Gibson, I take it personal when I see what I think is a reflection of laziness, obsession with ratings, skewed journalism, superficial journalism, and a situation which does not bode well for our country in this critical stage of our political development. And I'm very curious to how you will respond to this. In the last few primaries, after Ohio and particularly after Pennsylvania, and now from this point on to as we approach North Carolina and Indiana, I've noticed that Karl Rove, William Bennett, Pat Buchanan, William Kristol, and I may be missing, I don't know if Rush Limbaugh is in that element. These individuals who are to the right of Attila the Hun have been strongly supporting Hillary Clinton and at the expense, in my estimation, of Barack Obama. And I find that a very interesting conspiracy for me. And I wonder if you might have some inkling as to why this phenomenon is taking place.
Thank you. That's a great question, caller.
And, you know, I mean, I can say it one of two ways. It's not that I put it past them as active strategy, but let me just say that...
You mean the Republicans supporting Hillary
Clinton?
Exactly.
Republicans supporting Hillary Clinton, and also Republicans who supported early on, who seemed to say good things about Obama early on when Clinton seemed to be running ahead or looked like she was the presumptive front runner at that point. And Glenn Greenwald, who is writes at Salon.com and has a blog, had an interesting post in which he said, you know, maybe this is Republicans, and he's not the only one. This can be Republican strategy, and isn't it interesting how media just kind of track it and say, you know, Republicans are saying nice things about Obama. I guess that means he's kind of a bipartisan candidate, and bipartisanship is what we're looking for, and maybe that's good. They then change their allegiance to Hillary Clinton because their point is just to screw up the Democrats, and the media sort of say, huh, well, now Republicans are saying they don't really like Obama. He seems like he's, you know, perhaps too bitter or perhaps too something, and maybe Hillary Clinton appeals to their working class ideals more. In other words, Republicans, and Rush Limbaugh's just been very overt about it, are interested in sort of fooling around with the Democratic primary. They've been upfront about saying they want to get people to vote for whoever they think has a worse chance. You know, what's interesting to me is the way media seem to either consciously or just as it happens be kind of taking a page from that playbook, or kind of aiding and abetting that process by suggesting that anyone who that Republicans saying good things about Obama is a real valid feeling that's going on in the public, and it needs to be engaged as a political reality instead of considering it critically as perhaps something that's merely strategic and ought to be dismissed and engaged purely at that level.
Janine Jackson, one of the things that's emerging, and I thought of it as I listened to that last caller in the past, say, month or so, maybe it's slightly longer, is Hillary Clinton has recreated herself as, instead of being the insider who's sort of from the commanding heights of the Democratic Party in big business and is well-connected on Wall Street, is now the working-class gun-firing fighter for the working person who's going to take on the big companies. And Barack Obama is now being recast as the latte-drinking elitist who, you know, hang out with God knows who at some country club somewhere. And it's sort of interesting to see this spin, because is there any evidence for – I mean, are journalists – I'm just wondering, what point is a journalist supposed to actually – now, what's the evidence that backs up this sort of positioning?
Well, that's exactly what I mean, is kind of the way that a storyline just turns on itself and nothing in reality has actually shifted. What has shifted, perhaps, is talking points. You know, Hillary Clinton – sees how votes are going, and she sees that she wants to appeal to perhaps those working class whites who have indicated that race is a factor when they vote. In other words, that they will not vote for a black person. There could be a strategic decision on her campaign's part, but she needs to start wearing flannel shirts and putting down shots. You know, that's a campaign's decision. That's about public. That's about PR. It's nothing to do with journalism, which ought to be saying, well, the campaigns are positioning themselves this way. Their talking points are this. That's what they'd like to convince people of. Here is the reality. Here's whether that matches up or not. So, for example, you have Hillary Clinton, along with John McCain, calling for an utterly meaningless, ineffectual holiday from the gas tax. You know, something that would not, virtually every economist you can find will say that has no effect whatsoever on the price of gasoline. But it can still generate story after story just because the story is Clinton is doing this to appeal to working class people. And that's the story, not whether it actually will help working class people, not the reality, but just the selling campaign. Journalists think that that's enough to get a story out of. The fact that Clinton is calling for this and she's doing it because she wants to appeal to certain kinds of people, that's newsworthy. And you don't even need to include in that story whether it actually will have the effect she's saying it will. You know, the reality doesn't need to be in the story, because when it comes to campaigns, it seems for a lot of journalists, the story is just perception and PR and talking points and strategy. And again, that's not what the public wants, and that's not what the public says they want. It's not that people are ignorant. When they're asked, they can tell you exactly what they want to be hearing about with regard to this election. And it's not what we need.
Janine Jackson, we have a full bank of callers. I think you might be one of our most popular guests ever. Let's go to the callers right now. I want to make sure we get all of them on the air before the hour is over. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with Janine Jackson Affair.
Hi. Oh, what a treat to talk to Janine Jackson. I'm sorry I don't get to hear your show all the time. Okay, where do I start? Okay, record profits with the oil companies and record profits with the food companies, Cargill, and the other grain and other producers. Record profits at the expense of food shortages and record high gas and oil prices. Okay, now, Hillary just, I just heard Hillary recently say, and this was just, my jaw dropped when I heard Hillary say she actually supported a tax on windfall profits for the oil companies. Now, is this for real, or is she lying, or is, I mean, this is what's needed. Windfall profits tax. Okay, and also, this is, I got one other thing to say. I think it's a Republican dirty trick that they're overexposing Hillary and Barack Obama. They're overexposing them in the media to burn people out. And John McCain is a weak candidate. They're overexposing them. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, caller. Any comments, Janine Jackson?
Well, just that, you know, when you're trying to ask for one of the things that media talk about, the very least corporate media, is corporations. And to actually question the sort of the notion of ever-rising profit rates for corporations is one of the things that is truly off the page. It's one of the things that really gets you labeled a nut in mainstream media, because that worldview that basically what's good for big business is good for America is so internalized in these outlets. And so the kind of conversation that the caller is looking for, it's just not happening within the realms of corporate media. That just, unfortunately, is not the place to look for it to be in any sustained way. You know, how can we really engage food shortages? How can we really engage high gas prices? That's not the conversation you're going to get in the elite media of this country.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Chicago, you're on there with Janine Jackson.
Yeah, hi. Hello?
Yeah, you're on.
Okay. One of the things that's been bothering me for years, and there have been many others, but this, I suppose, is the prime thing about our politics, and that is that the press, those who publicly profess to believe that we have an independent media just don't know what they're talking about if they actually believe this. The fact is that our media has never been independent, that it has been tied with the Republican Party for generations. Even in the best of times, when the country was most liberal during the New Deal, only about 10% of the media supported FDR in any one of his elections. And it's been downhill ever since. The press essentially is part of the establishment. The establishment basically is Republican Party, the leaders of the Republican Party. And they work hand in glove with each other. And anything they publish is towards the end of the success of the Republican Party and so-called conservatism in this country.
All right. Well, caller, do you want Janine to comment on that?
Sure.
Okay, I'll ask her to do so. Janine Jackson, your thoughts?
Well, I'm not going to disagree, because I think, but I'm not one of those who's saying let's hearken back to the days in which journalism was ideal. You know, I think that's kind of a mental trap we can fall into. You tend to think that these times surely are the worst for U.S. journalism, and surely there was a time it was better. I'm not saying it wasn't better, but as a female, as a black person, I don't say, gosh, I wish it were the 50s again. You know, it's not like that. I think, however, what we do have are valuable traditions and valuable ideals, and it's kind of independent journalism is like democracy. You know, it's an experiment, and we're working on it, and that's what we're engaged in. So I certainly would agree that you can't simply hope that media will be generally independent. You have to accept that they are not, and you have to consume media with that knowledge. And as I always say, there's no substitute for being an independently informed citizen. You need to read widely, and I think that's just what that caller is pointing to. You can't just watch the news and think you've got the story.
Our guest is Janine Jackson, who you've just been listening to. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Great to talk to you guys. My name is Matthew Murray, and as self-disclosure, I should say that I do a media critique blog on NPR called NPR Check, and so I'm not a big fan of theirs. And I just was wondering if you would comment on, why I really don't understand how people consider NPR news liberal and why people often separate it from the rest of the corporate media, because it, in my opinion, is so establishment-centered and went right along with the Pentagon analysts, is very pro, I would say, pro-Israel as far as the conflict there. So I'll sit back and listen to your comments, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. Thank you for calling, Matthew.
Well, I absolutely agree. I mean, many times when we're putting together lists of, there's some particular thing that media are getting wrong or over-relying on the official line, NPR goes right in there with the networks, with the Times and the other big outlets. They don't, as a general rule, serve as an alternative in any way, shape, or form. And I know many listeners will know the history of public radio and public broadcasting in the country, which is one of a very beautiful ideal at the beginning. Of course, I know who I'm talking to, Bob. I know I'm not telling you. But, very, very soon, for various reasons, a kind of abandonment of that beautiful mission to serve as an alternative, to serve as a check, to serve as a place for voices that would be otherwise unheard. Instead, what we get from NPR is the same round of commentators, the same round of sources that we get from the major corporate outlets. There really isn't something to distinguish them in that regard. And that, I think, is what there is to distinguish them, and the same with public broadcasting on television, is the occasional very good program, the slightly less hysterical tone, and in this era of a very low threshold, those are things that people value. They listen to NPR maybe not because they think they're going to get a more progressive view, but because they don't want to be yelled at, So I think the caller is exactly right that in terms of substance, certainly political substance, certainly in terms of closeness to power, to serving as really an independent check on governments, to not over-favoring conservatives in many lines of inquiry, NPR is really no better.
Janine Jackson, I wonder also when they use the term liberal to describe NPR, or for that matter, Barack Obama, his following, liberal is sort of not, it's stripped away from economics and class and becomes
Absolutely.
This sort of lifestyle choice to drive a hybrid and drink expensive coffee. And, so you'll see class becomes constructed, and that thing is working class equals white people.
Right.
And black people somehow aren't working class. They're part of the elite now.
Absolutely. Yeah, in that equation. And then when you want to talk about them in a different way, they can shift another way that doesn't necessarily add up. Of all the – I've been at FAIR, 16 years now or so, and one of the pieces that I wrote for Extra, of which I'm proudest, was for the myth of the liberal media issue, in which I talked about the way people talk about media being liberal, and they really mean editorial positions that are pro-environment, say, or pro-reproductive rights. They have a number of social issues that for them define liberalism. When it comes to economic issues, and we find the media are liberal on some of those issues, the environment, reproductive rights. But when it comes to economic issues, the conservatism of media, the sort of pro, quote-unquote, free trade, the pro-corporate, pro-business outlook of media, It doesn't just, put a check on those social liberal tendencies. What I found when I looked at editorial positions was that it squashes them completely, So it really wins the day. Anything that media may call for in terms of liberal goals, they allow, sure, we'd like to generally improve worker rights. But then when a particular trade agreement comes up and it has particular details that actually don't that actually hurt workers, then journalists still support that trade deal because at the end of the day, their pro-corporate economic view is the dominant view and is allowed to, I believe, editorially squeeze out whatever social liberal tendencies they do have.
We have time for one more caller for our guest, Janine Jackson. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Bloomington, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I don't mean to rain on the parade, but I have some questions about the roles of critics of the media, and that is whether it really is an alternative, whether it's purely critical, or whether it actually can play a role in terms of redressing some kind of unfairness or the like. And the example I would have is the lack of a critical media attention to Winter Soldier, where 3 days of testimony of soldiers returning from Iraq, giving very, very moving testimony about how they've been made into moral monsters, as many of them called their tours over there. That was given no media coverage by the mainstream media. And the only alternative media that I know of that gave it any kind of was Democracy Now!, and I've heard very, very little attention played to the inattention of Winter Soldier. We tried to show it at Illinois State University, and they tried to shut it down. And there's something very strange about even the media critics not even redressing the media wrongs that they find committed and being as blind as the mainstream media.
Well, thank you very much for raising that point. And I think you're going to be surprised to find out that, or not surprised necessarily, that FAIR has actually worked on that.
Oh, absolutely. I want to start by saying, hey, it's not a parade. You know, yeah. you can't rain on it. You know, there aren't, at least, if there are media critics who think they are the most powerful figures on the scene, I don't know them. We're generally in a position of trying to call attention to systemic problems in media, not with the idea that the New York Times tomorrow is going to say, oh, FAIR, thank you so much, you're right, we will be different henceforth. You know, that's not the kind of power we exercise. What we can do is get people to question what they're reading in the paper. That's a kind of victory for us, is to grow awareness, you know, to grow critical awareness, so that that does, in turn, undermine the ability of these outlets to control people's thinking, because once people realize they can't just believe that they're going to hear about everything they need to hear about from the Times, then you've really planted a seed. You've really planted a revolutionary seed that's going to change the way they consume information. Now, we did do a big alert on the blackout, particularly at the New York Times, of Winter Soldier. We had a back and forth with the public editor. I would very much encourage the caller and anyone else who hasn't seen it to go to FAIR.org and read our initial action alert on the Winter Soldier blackout. And please also read the response of the New York Times public editor, Clark Hoyt, because it's really revelatory, the New York Times' explanation for why they did not send a reporter to the Winter Soldier hearings. It did get coverage on Alternet and a few other places, but the caller's right that it has attention and that it should have, and that's one of the many, many things that FAIR works on every day.
And we only have about 30 seconds or if that left, Janine Jackson. If people want to learn more about FAIR, the website, the place to go?
The website is the place to go. You can find out. It's FAIR.org. You can find out about subscribing to our print magazine, Extra, where you can hear Counterspin, the radio show, and also the Action Alert Network, which you talked about earlier, where you can sign up for that and will be in your mailbox not too often, but just enough to keep you angry and hopefully doing something about it.
Janine Jackson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure, as always, to have you as our guest. Keep up the great work.
Well, you do the same.
And I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. My producer, Andrew Boyle, as always, doing a wonderful job. Today, sitting in the Hall of Fame of Board Operators, Mike Pritchard, handling the board for us. Thank you, Mike, for doing that. We'll be back in 167 hours with another show. Until then, have a wonderful week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, Ed Kieser says sunny and pleasant with a high of 66 degrees. Wind from the southwest at 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low of 42 and southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and warmer, the high 72 degrees. Tomorrow night, partly to mostly cloudy with the low around 50 degrees.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. From his Nobel Peace Prize to his recent meeting with Hamas, former President Jimmy Carter continues to defy convention, and he joins us to talk about the woman who championed his courage and character, his mother, Miss Lily.
My mama never paid any attention to racial segregation. She treated black people and white people exactly the same. And she was so powerful that even the condemnation or criticism of her neighbors made no impression on my mother. And she continued that all her life.
Also, commentator Cornel West says the media has gotten it wrong regarding the controversy over Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Lynette Calfani Cox has advice for how to spend those tax rebate checks. Plus, we'll hear new work from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jhumpa Lahiri and musical legend Johnny Mathis. This hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.